So today I'm joined by Jason Graves, who of course has got a huge background in the industry. He's worked on so many titles and so many huge and impressive things that people have loved over the years. So it's great to be joined by you today, Jason.
So nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
I hope all's going well your end.
Oh yeah, all things consideredly, you know, things are just fine. How about you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been a busy, busy week because always working on this series, but you know, that's passion for you, I guess.
True.
So I guess the major subject that we were going to concentrate on today was the game Moss, which was actually released 2 years ago, but there's still a fair amount worth digging into there.
Yeah, that game has really got some serious legs, and we did an expansion pack that came out, well, when was it? Six or 8 months ago, I guess. It was a free expansion pack for anyone who owned the game. And that it was a pretty, for, as far as I know, I mean, extra multiple hours of gameplay for free with new music and everything, new voiceover, everything. It was really fun.
Oh, that's excellent. I wasn't actually aware of that. And that's fantastic to hear. And how long ago was that, did you say? Sorry.
I finished the music about this time last year, but I think the game came out maybe, the expansion came out like in June or something like that.
It's just always great to hear these kinds of add-on things. And actually, it's a question I bring up a lot whenever there is DLC or things like that, is like, how does it actually feel to like return to a project that you'll have put so much into in its initial run?
I've experienced that a couple of times. And the first time was this old game, you know, from 1783 called Blazing Angels. It was a World War II aerial combat game, and I had a lot of fun working on it. And then they came back for Blazing Angels 2, I think it was subtitled Secret Missions, and asked me to do some more music. And that was super cool because I was able to reference, you know, some of the older themes from the first one and put them in new perspective almost for the second one. And it's kind of like a lot of the hard work has already been finished because you've got some themes and you kind of have your sounds organized, unless the second game has changed a lot. But most of the time when I've worked on it, it's, you know, it's a logical extension of what the previous game was doing. So that was pretty straightforward. And I did the same thing with a World War II submarine series called Silent Hunter. I did a couple of those. I think it was maybe 4 and 5. I did a lot of World War II stuff in this kind of five-year group of my career. But the one that really got me, which is probably the first thing I should have said, the one that really got me was when I did the first Dead Space, and then they wanted the sequel, Dead Space 2. And I was honestly, like, creatively completely out of ideas because I'd poured so much of my heart and soul into the first one. And then it got a lot of recognition that I wasn't really expecting. And then a year later, it's sort of like, well, how am I supposed to top that? I mean, everyone seemed to really love it and I'm really glad that they liked it, but man, now I have to do something in my mind that needs to be better, you know, bigger and better and more of everything while not treading old ground. And I remember I called Gary Scheinman because we've been friends for a long time and we have a lot of similar musical passions. And I think he had just started working on the sequel to BioShock maybe 6 months beforehand. And I remember where I was in my house kind of pacing on my cell phone. I'm like, I don't even know what to do. I mean, what did you do? How did you even think about beginning to go back to that world and try to improve on what you had already done and people really, really loved and you won so many awards for? And he's like, you know, it's not that hard. It seems hard to you now because you're not actually doing it. But once you see the game and you see the gameplay, you know the story, and you actually start thinking about what music needs to go with it, it's going to figure itself out because they're not remaking the first Dead Space. I'm sure they're going to go in a slightly different direction with it, and it's going to have new characters and a new story and maybe even a new setting. And he said, that's, you know, that's the way it is with BioShock, because we both agree on so many things, one of them being that the game is ultimately what drives the narrative of the music because the music's really telling the story of the game. So they're kind of circular. And he was totally right. It was a different plot, different storyline. You know, Isaac had a big, much more of a character arc, different everything. And I was able to come up with some ideas and some new things that I'd never done before. String quartet for video game music and all this fun stuff. And I eventually overcame it. And actually, personally, I like the score for Dead Space 2 more than the score for Dead Space 1, just on a personal on a personal level. That's me completely going off the rails and answering one simple question with a 5-minute response.
No, that is exactly what we want on this show, and that's pretty much precisely what my listeners expect.
Oh, well, then you've come to the right place.
Oh, yeah, because my show is always packed with long, long tangents and super, super in-depth stuff. So that's exactly, this is where you need to get all of that off your chest. Absolutely.
Fantastic.
So you were talking about it being general expansions in general when you do this kind of thing, be it sequels or expansions and DLC and things like that. But I guess that can actually, like, even if you are having to work with old themes and even old styles and atmospheres and find new ways to bring them back to life, that in itself can be really creative, actually, for a musician, can it not? Like, finding new ways to put old themes in new contexts.
Yeah, it is. That's a great way of putting it, because you've sort of, like I said before, figured out the hard parts, at least what I always like to do first. And the things that I do first always seem hardest because you're just starting to get into it. But I'm trying to figure out the instrumentation and if there's a main theme and kind of what it needs to sound like and what the overall, you know, vibe of the game's going to be. And if you've already played around in that world for multiple hours of music a couple of years ago, you know, hopefully I've learned new things since then, and there's new stuff that I want to try out, and I kind of hit the ground running from where I left off previously. And it's like you get a leg up almost. You don't have to worry about, well, maybe I want to have a different theme, but I can still use the, you know, the original theme. And it's like new sparks and new ideas, kind of standing on the shoulders of the previous composer. You just happen to be the previous composer.
Right, and that's really interesting, because that leads me into another thing I was going to ask about as well. And it's funny, because we've kind of come into this interview backwards, which is no problem there, because this is all the questions that I've left to the end, and we'll probably end up coming to Moss later on down the line.
Sure, no problem.
Which is no problem at all. But you talk about following on a previous composer, and in this case, it being you. But obviously, one of the things I was really interested about was your work on the Tomb Raider reboot. And I've spoken to Nathan McCree on this this podcast 3 times, I think, now. And we've discussed Tomb Raider at length and the original 3 soundtracks quite a lot. So it'd be quite remiss of me to not bring that up with you while you were here and talk about the work that you did on Tomb Raider and how you might have felt stepping into a series that does have such prestige, and not just Nathan McCree, but so many other fantastic composers have put their stamp on it too.
Yeah, it was definitely, I don't want to say scary, because that sounds negative. I was very, very excited, but I was also maybe wary? I don't know. I was treading lightly. Let's put it that way. I'm, self-admittedly, I'm horrible at video games. My best friend in high school could literally, we could go to the arcade, and he could play like 1941, which was a World War II top-down airplane shooter. He could play for an hour on a single quarter. And I would just sit there and watch him. And it was like, it was better than watching TV, because he's, you know, he's going through every level and getting extra lives and doing all this super cool stuff that I could never do. And then literally I would get a quarter and I'd be finished in 2 minutes. It was just, I guess I didn't put the practice in. I was always practicing instruments. I had lessons on, you know, anything from vibraphones to snare drum and timpani and piano lessons and guitar lessons and singing lessons and dancing lessons. And when it came to playing games, it was more fun and less like lots and lots and lots of hours put in where I was really good at it. So that sort of extended to consoles when they came around. I do love listening to film music. I don't listen to it as much as I did maybe the first 10 years of my career. But one of the things that I always make sure I do is go out of my way to avoid listening to anything that might be associated, you know, with the title I'm working on. And with Tomb Raider, that meant, you know, don't listen to any Tomb Raider soundtracks, because I didn't want the previous music to influence what I was doing on the current game. And this was also a strong recommendation from Crystal Dynamics. They weren't looking for, you know, a retroactive score or anything that was musically referencing the previous titles. They were looking for a completely clean reboot. They wanted to reboot the whole thing and have an original theme that was new and, you know, like everything from scratch. So that kind of worked for me. It's funny because there'll be... I did a game called Man of Medan that came out last summer, I believe, with Supermassive Games. And I work with them on Until Dawn before that. And very much like Dead Space, they had a video, the EA team working on Dead Space kind of had a proof of concept video that showed clips from films and had a soundtrack from a film playing underneath it that was maybe 2 or 3 minutes long. And the idea was it's kind of a mood setter. It gives you, you know, the vibe of the game and kind of what to expect emotionally from it. And I remember for Dead Space, they used Event Horizon, which was a really cool sci-fi movie. And I think they used some music from, like, maybe Jerry Goldsmith's Alien, or maybe it was even something from Event Horizon. I don't remember what it was. But I intentionally didn't. I tried really hard not to listen to it because I didn't want to be influenced by it. And with Man of Medan, they had something similar, except they were talking a lot about, from a sound perspective, this movie called Ghost Ship. And Man of Medan is literally about a ghost ship. And the audio director said, hey, if you don't have that soundtrack, I can send it over to you. I was like, no, I've got it, no problem. He's like, great. So there's a couple of places, like, you know, take it or leave it, but this track has an interesting spot here with some strings in the background doing kind of an effect that might be neat. And we were having a phone conversation, and he sent me the email notes, and I never listened to the soundtrack. I've got, like, the, you know, the unreleased studio recordings of so many different film scores, but I made it a point to never listen to Ghost Ship, because the last thing I wanted anyone to do was to play Man of Medan and go, you know what, this really sounds like John Frizzell's score to Ghost Ship, and because they're both about ghost ships. And I knew if I listened to it, it would influence me, even subconsciously. There'd be something going on, and something would slip out that was, you know, the wrong sort of influence in terms of originality and the way I like to work. So I tend to run away screaming with my arms up in the air from any sort of obvious references about anything that has to do with the project I'm working on. Even when people ask me to listen to things, it's I didn't tell Barney, the audio director, that I didn't listen to anything until after we finished the soundtrack for Man of Medan. And he said something like, yeah, really great. You know, the strings and whatever, you know, I think we really kind of hit that vibe for Ghost Ship, but I don't think you've spent too much time listening to it, did you? I said, I didn't listen to it a single time. He's like, yeah, that's kind of what I figured. And so the same thing for Tomb Raider. They didn't ask me to listen to anything. I actually didn't have any of the Tomb Raider soundtracks. And there was an ambient thing going on at the beginning when Lara's first on the island and she's exploring. And I was sitting with Alex Weimer, who was kind of the audio lead that was implementing all of the music that I was writing. And an oboe did like a little da-da-dum, I think it was. And he's like, you know, I really like that. That's just so classy and simple. And I was like, oh, well, that's cool. And he said, was it hard to quote the original Tomb Raider theme, like, in your own way, or did it just kind of come out like that? And I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. He's like, oh, huh. You know, Tomb Raider, it's an oboe, the theme, it's an oboe, and it's these real simple notes. I was just using bum, 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 the third, fourth, and fifth note of my theme that was originally on piano. I just kind of had the oboe playing it. But just the fact that it had, like, note, 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 kind of three equally paced slow notes on the oboe, and you were playing a Tomb Raider game, even the audio director thought that I was intentionally referencing the original theme from the first three games, which is great. I have no problem with that because I didn't do it on purpose. I don't mind if people infer things. You know, everyone's past experience is basically the lens by which they hear any new music. And my daughter, I had something with bongos in it, and she's like, "Ooh, The Incredibles," because she thinks like, you know, real fast bongo stuff to her. That's like her kind of big band Incredibles 60s spy stuff. And I was like, yeah, Incredibles. It's interesting. But yeah, so big shoes to fill for sure. And I didn't need to make them any bigger by burdening myself with all the previous music that had been written. And in a way, you know, when you think that way, and the developer lets you think that way, you're really creatively free to do a lot more. I wanted to make the theme like a very internal kind of self-sacrifice, trying to become better through struggle, that kind of a thing, rather than, I don't know what everybody else did for their Tomb Raider themes, but that was my take.
Well, it's really interesting to hear because admittedly, I interview a fair amount of people on the show, and admittedly, I can't have played every game that they've ever worked on. But when it comes to this, I grew up being a big fan of Tomb Raider on the PlayStations, and I specifically completed the reboot 3 times.
Wow.
When it originally came out. So, and I specifically remember when playing through it for the first time, almost kind of waiting for that first, for that 3-note theme from the original. And then by the end of the game, when it kind of hadn't come and it had kind of been this mostly original thing, I found that really refreshing. Actually, I was like, no, yeah, we're in reboot territory and we're starting this again. There's no need to go back to that.
Right. I think that was the developer's general idea. You know what I loved about Tomb Raider? I was afraid that they were going to want to kind of have wall-to-wall music and just, you know, as soon as she's in combat or running away from something, it's just big, all-out action music. And I was really interested in her character arc and how she starts out very unsure and she grows, you know, with other folks' help. She grows as a person and as a warrior, and she goes from like being scared and running away to actually defending herself and other people. And I wanted to musically do that. So at the beginning, there's actually not a lot of theme in the game itself, you know, maybe over the main titles and in a couple of key moments for the first 2/3 of the game. But it's not the sort of what you would expect typical video game action music to be. You know, like the big pounding drums and the huge French horns and the orchestra backing up everything. And I didn't know if Crystal was going to go for that or not. You actually don't hear that kind of thing with the giant taiko drums and French horns and kind of expected sort of action music until like the last couple of levels in the game. And then hopefully when that does come and kind of kick in and it's sort of the type of empowering music that makes you feel like, you know, you're ready to kick ass and take names, as opposed to, I'm not sure if I can do this. The music's telling me I need to be scared. It's kind of disabling me emotionally instead of empowering and enabling me. Those are sort of the two sides of the coin I was looking for. And fortunately, Crystal totally went for it. We had a nice stripped down score that slowly built up and then really kicked in the last kind of final act of the game, and of course the cliffhanger at the end. But it was real fun shaping that score that way.
Yeah, I loved seeing that origin story unfold, actually, because that whole build up into the Lara Croft that we see in that reboot was never really an aspect of the original 3 games, and I really, really enjoyed playing through that. And we've talked a lot about you working on these games where you have had to, well, maybe the idea was essentially to look back on past scores, but we've talked about how you kind of deliberately blinded yourself to that. But then how about something that you might not have necessarily been able to ignore, like Star Trek? I assume that you had probably come across some episodes or movies or something like that before working on the several Star Trek games you've worked on, actually.
Yes, definitely.
And this is something I had to bring up, man, because I'm a gigantic Trekkie, so I couldn't leave it.
Yeah, totally. I totally understand. That was crazy because Jerry Goldsmith is really one of my favorite film composers ever. And I mean, I love Wrath of Khan. I thought James Horner really, really killed it on Wrath of Khan. But that first Star Trek score, okay, any of the scores that Goldsmith did for Star Trek, I just really, really love. And before I had even been working on that set of Star Trek games, I had already picked apart, especially harmonically, a lot of his cues from the films that he worked on for Star Trek. Because I just love the way he does harmony and the way he kind of leads you on a journey, especially kind of in the bridge sections before it modulates and you hear the main theme again in the new key, like, you know, really big and loud. So, yeah, I was intimately familiar with all the Star Trek stuff. And I kind of had to close that lid a little bit, but at the same time kind of open it every now and then to peek in, because they were not looking for, and they shouldn't have been looking for, a reboot of anything. It's just supposed to be a continuation, right? These games existed in the universe that all the films and TV shows existed in. So harmonically speaking, especially, it needed to sound like it was comfortable there. And that's really an easier task to do, because there's so much of it out there, I think, and it kind of had already permeated the way I think and my thoughts and ideas about music, because I'm such a fan anyway. So it was just more like, you know, make sure that it doesn't sound exactly like the theme. I think for them to license the theme from Paramount, just for me to do a MIDI version of, was going to be more than the entire music budget. That's why we didn't use the main theme from Jerry Goldsmith's Star Trek. But I did have a really great time writing it. And it was funny because I was in, where was I? In Spain? I think I was in Spain for a game music concert, you know, 7 or 8 years ago. And I conducted a bunch of stuff myself of my own work, including Tomb Raider and Blazing Angels, actually. And then they had this suite of Star Trek music that another friend of mine was conducting, because he had worked on Star Trek. And right smack dab in the middle of the suite was my main theme from the Star Trek games that I had written. I didn't even know that he was doing it. And he didn't know that I had written it, because it was just sort of in this group of, you know, well, here's some Star Trek themes. And he did his own arrangement of it. And, you know, so I'm sitting there in the audience with my wife, and all of a sudden the orchestra starts playing my Star Trek music. I looked over, I was like, that's my theme. That's crazy. It's very cool. Small world.
Yeah, that's absolutely brilliant. And that can kind of lead us back onto Moss, because one of the things I wanted to talk about was, it's been a while now, let's say maybe over the past 10 years or so, where video game music, I feel, has had this big explosion of recognition and has started to really make waves and start to make it the name for itself that it always deserved. It's starting to show up on radio stations, have entire radio shows, live concerts, exactly like what you're talking about. And one thing that really interested me to tie into Moss was things like vinyl releases, because there is a vinyl release of the Moss soundtrack as well.
Yes, there is.
I wondered how you felt about this explosion of recognition for video game music, because I don't think video game music vinyls was necessarily something that was happening around 10 years ago.
Oh, goodness, no. I remember back in those days when I was working on those World War II games, it was probably 15 or 17 years ago, I was making my own promos of the soundtracks. Because especially with smaller games like that, everything was, you know, a minute or a minute and a half long. Sometimes cues would even be 30 seconds or 15 seconds. They just didn't have huge budgets that the big AAAs do now. They'd be 40 minutes of music all chopped up into little tiny pieces. So whenever I finished a soundtrack, I knew it wasn't going to get a release. No one was releasing game soundtracks back then. So I just do a promo for myself. And then if anybody wanted to, I'd give them some MP3s. And I remember, what was the first official soundtrack that was released? You know, now I can't remember, because I was doing pretty serious promos. But I remember doing those promos and thinking, man, if we could get official releases of these soundtracks, it would be so cool, because I'd be able to listen to other people's music as well. But this was just when like iTunes was starting to come around, and you could buy a digital copy of a soundtrack. And I was hoping that with everything switching to digital and you just being able to download it instead of having to buy the physical disc, that maybe not having to put out the cash for all the printed physical copies would enable game soundtracks to maybe, you know, get a leg up and start getting some official distribution. And that's what started happening, slowly but surely. And then, bam, you fast forward 15 years, we've got vinyl. I think I have 7 or 8 soundtracks that are on vinyl now. And that's just crazy to me. And I get it, because I would want vinyl of a game or a film that I was a big fan of, and I love the music. Why wouldn't anybody else want that? It's definitely been the largest form of entertainment in terms of revenue for the last, I don't remember when games passed film. It was 5 or 6 years ago. It's huge. I mean, it's the number one revenue grosser for entertainment in the world. And I have like a kind of royalty system with Moss in terms of my soundtrack sales, just like I do with all my other soundtracks. And I just got a statement a couple of weeks ago, actually, and there's been something like 6,000 soundtracks sold for Moss, which just completely blows my mind. Now, I know it's probably not the same as something like Journey that Austin did, or maybe God of War that that Bear put together, you know, really, really like super, super popular console-type games. Moss's VR, it's got a very small audience, but also everyone who bought the game gets the soundtrack for free. So that means that there's like 6,000 people out there who bought it outside of actually owning the game, and that's huge. It's like, I feel like soundtracks have finally gone from being looked at, originally they were money losers in terms of, you know, a publisher's bottom line, because they'd have to, you know, print these CDs or get the lawyers to put together contracts to have virtual online copies or host a store on the internet or whatnot, and there was never really any guarantee anything would sell, and all they were really hoping to do is maybe break even on the cost to put up the storefront for the soundtrack. Where now, yeah, 6,000 units at $10 a pop, you know, you're covered, and then you're actually making some money, and that money is going to both the Materia Collective with Sebastian's Place, who is printing the CDs and the and the vinyl, as well as Moss developers and the Moss composer. And, you know, no one's going to retire on it, but it's, you know, it's a little drip in the bucket, which is really nice. Honestly, I was more impressed by the fact that that many people would pay money for my music than I really cared if I was getting a royalty check for it or not. It's more the appreciation, sort of the emotional support than anything else.
Well, it is a really, really gorgeous soundtrack, so I certainly don't blame these people buying it at all. And you've mentioned that it does have a relatively small audience with it being a VR game, because of course we haven't talked much about what Moss actually is, and it is this really interesting VR storybook experience that tells the story of a little mouse. And it's got this gorgeous music by you on top of it, with a lot of really interesting stuff going on in it that I definitely wanted to cover. And since we've kind of gone through this interview backwards, I guess I'll start from the ending with it, because it's really interesting here with the track "Home to Me," which includes vocals from Maluka, if I'm not wrong.
She's such an incredible musician. All right, that's the last track on the CD because it is on the end credits when you play the game. And I even wrote the cinematic that closes the game. Basically, I put kind of a preemptive chord that leads straight into "Home to Me," because the song that Maluka sang on starts right when the credits start. But that wasn't anything that was on the short list, shall we say, for needed cues for the game. They didn't ask for a song. I've never written a song, and no one really knew what was going on, except I wrote the lyrics first and sent them off to Polyarc to make sure that I was capturing the kind of the right feel through the lyrics, because obviously the lyrics are super important. And I'd never written a song before. I'd never written lyrics for a song. So I also wanted to make sure they were giving me the thumbs up for everything. But it was real easy to write because the game is just gorgeous. And the fact that you're kind of a partner with Quill, so it's VR and you're an actual tangible character in the game, but only Quill can see you. And she'll look right at you and you can high five her, and you are controlling her, you know, with one of your thumbsticks in the VR space, but you also have a presence. So when you're looking around, you know, you're physically standing in that space and she's looking up at you, and you get all those wonderful different perspectives that I love when you can see, like when she's really tiny and you're up tall, kind of standing at full height, looking down. And then other times she'll fill up the screen right in front of you because you're at the ground level with her. And the mouse, the squirrel, you know, that maybe might be kind of a mouse steed, a mouse might ride a squirrel, is the size of a horse to you because you're right down on her level. So I just felt like it needed some kind of a song. And I really, really, really wanted to work with Maluka. I had her on Far Cry Primal, maybe whenever it came out, a couple years before that. And there were three tribes in Far Cry Primal, and one of them was supposed to be kind of this religious, ancient, sort of mystical tribe. And I immediately contacted her and said, hey, I finally found something we can work on. We're going to need to do these cool ethereal vocals. And she sang all this beautiful stuff. We did a couple of songs. I used her lower range, and it was great. And I was thinking, yes, finally, I get to do something that's not just scary music all the time. And then Ubisoft called me, and they said, okay, that tribe is now just going to be basically murderers that eat people. So we just needed to be really scary. And I think the audio director literally said, you know, you can do scary, right? I'm like, yeah, I can do scary. And I was thinking, well, geez, so can I use Maluka? Or I don't know what the best thing to do. And actually, the audio director was the one that suggested doing some battle cries or war cries or something like that. So I remember Skyping with her. I said, everything's great. They love everything you've done. It's been incredible. And she's sort of like, but? Because she could tell that I was leading to something. I'm like, we have to change it all. And I said, you know, I haven't written anything yet because we're tossing out the old stuff, but it would be really cool. Maybe I write one piece and you just give me some just random shrieks and shouts and whispers. And it just is freaked out and scary horror movie kind of thing as you can get. And I think with that one track that I sent her, she gave me so much material. I wrote like 4 or 5 songs underneath it. And I literally would. I'd find like the coolest, like, rah, 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 rah. You know, she'd do something like that. I'd be like, oh my gosh. So I put this, and I just write kind of all the crazy drums and percussion underneath her vocal. And, it was inspiring to write music that way, but she also was pretty uncomfortable doing it because she'd never done anything like that. And I was like, well, welcome to my job. Pretty much every gig I have, I end up finding myself doing something I've never done before, and I'm kind of uncomfortable too. But I promise you, it's going to be super cool when it's finished. And she did a super great job, but I kind of felt like I tricked her into it a little bit. So with Moss, it was like, okay, I know we're not going to be changing this into a horror song. It's not going to be scary. You know, I sent her the lyrics, and I sent her kind of a quick scratch of just like a piano and shaker and like bass drum loop mock-up of the chords. And we Skyped a couple times and figured out the right key for her range because I wanted to be able to do a little bit of falsetto, but for the most part, stay in her beautiful lower range, which I just love. And I think we did 3 or 4 passes before I recorded all the instruments, like the whole band. We settled on tempos and keys and all that sort of stuff. And she sent me a bunch of amazing tracks that just so, I mean, obviously the vocals are the key to a song when there's lyrics. But man, I mean, she just sang it. I mean, I get goosebumps every time I hear her singing it. And the idea was I did that first, and that was kind of my proving ground for the themes. So there was a bunch of three or four kind of different musical ideas in there that I just ended up taking and propagating throughout the rest of the score. So my original thinking was, you go see a movie, and maybe it's got a super cool score. And they don't do as much now, but back in the day, I'd be in the theater and I'd be really enjoying it. And then the credits would come up and there'd be just some randomly licensed pop song. And it's like, why am I listening to this? Oh, because the lyrics have like moon in them or something, and it was a vampire movie or whatever. I'm like, this is just not, I'm not feeling the consistency here. This feels like, you know, just a cash grab to put a pop song on the soundtrack. And I wanted the end credits for the game to feel like they were still part of the same universe, because they look like it and they're talking about the people that made the game. So why don't we do a song that kind of ties it all up with this beautiful bow? And so that was the idea. Song was first, and then the rest of the score was written with all of those themes.
Yeah, but it does feel like this kind of triumphant thing, because as you say, it takes a more of a band approach. And I remember in particular thinking that the drums on it were absolutely fantastic, which kind of leads me... honestly, they're brilliant. I do a little live show, which this is actually going to go out afterwards, where I do play music and such. I'm playing that tomorrow, 100%. It's really, really good, man.
Oh, thanks.
Those drums really gripped into me. But I'm a bass player, so rhythm section always jumps out at me.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I thought long and hard about the drum part, because everything in the song is live. The strings, I had soloists that played all the parts for the strings, and Kristen Nagus played all the woodwinds, and obviously Maluka was live, and then everything else was just me, guitars and accordion and ukulele and bass and drums and all the percussion and stuff. But it's like, you know, I like the idea. There weren't any drum kit. There weren't any beats or anything in the score. Just some percussion and maybe a couple of like kind of cinematic, bigger toms, but not a drum set. So I didn't want them to sound, you know, boom, ta-ka, boom, ta-ka, like have a big groove going. And I've always been a huge fan of like Omar Hakim and Dave Weckl and guys like that, Peter Erskine, that do like kind of crossover beats. You know, it doesn't sound like a rock groove or a funk groove, but it also doesn't sound like he's playing a samba or some sort of a traditional African kind of a thing. So I didn't use any cymbals on the kit at all. And you won't notice it just because it's not there. But if there was a big crash cymbal or a big ride cymbal or anything like that, it would definitely kind of, in my mind, steer the song to more contemporary kind of feeling. I wanted it to be very, you know, like it was almost like a world beat of some kind, but it wasn't any particular ethnic origin. Just like the rest of the score. You know, I was going for something that sounded timeless and didn't sound like the flavor of the year, or sound like I was going for a particular, you know, oh, this is 1680 medieval England, or, you know, I wanted it to seem like it had been there forever. And that included the drums and the electric bass in the song. Like, they're not overbearing, hopefully. It's just part of the groove. It's all about groove for me, and as it must be for you too, because, you know, me and the bass player, I swear, if I didn't play drums, I would have played bass. And I play bass all the time now. It's so much fun to play. I was just doing something the other day, this like 70s thing. So much fun on bass. It's like a really, really fun instrument to play.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons why that beat stuck out for me, because it had that real jittery kind of snare groove on it that I felt like I could probably really get down with if I had my bass in my hands at the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it was absolutely great. But it's interesting to talk about all this kind of the band stuff you were doing on this credits track, because the rest of the score otherwise is completely orchestral. And we've heard a little bit about your background of learning various instruments when other people were maybe learning arcade games. But then when yeah. When did you start to take on the orchestra? And you see, I'm a pretty accomplished musician myself, and I still can't get my head around how somebody can compose for an orchestra. It just seems so, the amount you'd have to learn for it just seems unbelievable.
I understand that too, because I still remember I was in LA for school, for graduate school, for film and television music. And after I got out of the school, I stayed for the summer, but it just wasn't really my cup of tea. I ended up coming home. But on the flight home, I had bought, what was it? Hold on a second, and I can remember. It was a Star Wars suite. And it was the orchestral, like the official orchestral printing of like five songs from the original Star Wars trilogy. And one of them was the Imperial March. And I very much, you know, honestly, I think that you and I are a lot more similar, because you coming from a bass background and me coming from a drum background, the orchestra, that's a big band. It's a lot of, you know, a lot of musicians going on, and there's so many different ways that they can play so many different things. And, you know, you can voice one chord in the strings like 50 different ways, depending on how you want it to sound and how do you know how it's going to sound unless you hear it. And it was very overwhelming for sure. And being a drummer, I felt even more at, a loss, because I wasn't even in the orchestra. It wasn't like I played oboe or cello or had kind of, you know, been groomed around that sort of musicality. I was playing in bands and, you know, we're doing like Tom Petty and Hootie and the Blowfish and all this, you know. I was in a blues band. I played keyboards in a blues band in college, and I played drums and a tiny bit of bass in another kind of top 40 band. But that's about as far and removed from orchestra as you can get. I played in jazz bands and like pickup trios and stuff like that as well on drums. But I remember seeing the score for the Imperial March and, you know, the dun, 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 dun. I saw on the score that it was literally just trumpets and trombones in octaves. The trumpets were on the top octave, the trombones were on the bottom octave, and they were just playing like perfect octaves for the whole theme. It's like, wow.
See, I'm always so scared to be that simple. I always imagine there's a lot more going on than that.
Well, there was a lot going on. Like, you know, the strings are going, dun, gada the gung, gada the gung, gada the gada the gung, gung. You know,
oh, yeah, of course, like, of course, yeah.
There's so much going on around it. But
I always imagine that every single instrument has to be playing a different note or phrase, that nobody can be doubling up or something. I just make that assumption for some reason.
I know. And I think it's, I think a lot of people, it's through inexperienced, you know, it's not an inexperienced ear. It's not that you don't know how to listen to orchestra music, but, you know, sitting down and saying, okay, I'm going to write a 30-second piece with orchestra that's just like, you know, a simple pastoral kind of thing. And you start trying to figure out what to do. And then, yeah, you realize if you start taking all of your flutes and all of your trumpets and all of your violins and having them all play the same thing, like at the same register, then the orchestra starts sounding more like an organ. And you're like, well, I don't want that. I don't want it to sound like an organ. But then when you start having them do more disparate things, then all of a sudden nothing is really cutting through, right? There's too much going on. And I actually, right now, I mean, we are living history, 1:03. I would be wrapping up in San Francisco, literally the last 10 minutes of my talk on rhythm in music, right now in San Francisco, because GDC is this week, and my talk was at, I believe it was at 1, from 1 to 2, maybe it was 2 to 3, but it was today, and it was this afternoon, and we're, like, really doing it. This is the substitute, I suppose.
I'm sorry to hear you was affected by that. I wasn't actually aware of that.
Oh, everything's been canceled over here. I mean, everyone's all shut up, and I think it's for the better anyway. But my point was, oh yeah, one of the things that I was going to talk about, the whole talk was music from a drummer's perspective, and it was about rhythm and groove. And I have example pieces that I was going to play of orchestra music that I've written, where I'm basically treating the orchestra like a drum set. You know, you've got the low kick drum, the bass drum, right? It's not playing all the time. It's like doom, 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 doom. Dun, 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 dun. And then the snare drum is like alternating. Usually the bass drum and the snare drum aren't playing at the same time, so they're sort of a dun, gack, dun, dun, gack, dun, dun, gack. You know, they're doing a little back and forth, and then the hi-hat is going the whole time, just tick, 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 tick. but that's the highest sound. And that's how I always treated the orchestra. If it was low stuff, I'd keep it simple. And I'd have some stuff in the middle register, maybe of the strings and the trombones, that weren't getting in the way of the low stuff. And then the higher stuff, like the violins or the high woodwinds, they could be a little busier. But I never really did more than three ideas in terms of, musical kind of lines and themes and things like that. I never got too complicated for fear of it getting lost, especially if it was going to be performed live. You can cheat a lot in the computer. I'm just going to turn it up. I know it's impossible to hear the flutes with everybody else playing so loud, but I can do it in the computer, so I'm going to turn it up and make it work. But that would never cut it if you were recording live. It would just be drowned out. So, you know, like a lot of other things, I love studying and I love learning. And I probably have, hundreds of scores, orchestral scores now, both classical and film scores. Film scores are kind of like Cliff's Notes. Do you have Cliff's Notes over there?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Absolutely, yeah.
It's like film score. The composers for film or the orchestrators for film music are really just condensing and summarizing, what Wagner or Beethoven or Liszt or whomever did over a 90-minute piece, they're condensing that all into a 3-minute film score because the film is changing constantly, so the score is changing constantly. So it's really a nice condensed way of figuring out some of these tricks. And like anything else, you learn something 1 week and then it's old hat by week 2 and you're learning something else and you just keep adding those feathers to your cap. And then before you know it, it's been 15 years and every time I'm in front of an orchestra, I learn something new, but I definitely, it's like I remember when I'm conducting the orchestra at a recording session or at a concert, I will never forget kind of what that sounds like now. So when I go back home and I'm using the computer to try to make orchestra sounds, because of budget or schedule or anything like that, I'm always trying to recreate that feeling I get when I'm standing in front of the orchestra. But that's like anything else. It takes time. Geez, have you ever tried to play a violin? I can't even get a good note out of an open string. So I don't understand how they do such fast runs and everything. But they're like, yeah, well, we've been doing it for 30 years and my instrument costs, $700,000. My bow cost $90,000. This is all I do, so I'm really good at it.
Yeah, and over those 30 years, as you say, you're going to consistently get posed new challenges, which always teach you new things, which I guess to round this up, and one of the last things I wanted to talk about when it comes to orchestras is that, yeah, sure, it might be difficult enough to get the balance in one track in that uses one particular style, but orchestra itself can be so unbelievably diverse, which comes across on just the Moss soundtrack, but even more so if you look at your career in general. Like if you listen to Dead Space next to Moss, both orchestral, both completely different. So is it that then, that when you come to certain new games, that you just have to step up to the challenges rather than like taking some kind of intensive 3-year orchestral course that kind of teaches you how to do every style?
You know, it's funny because I sort of feel like when I get a new job, especially if it's for live orchestra, I am taking on an intense, 1 to 2 year study in orchestra, because usually there's a certain kind of sound, even if I don't hear it in my head yet, there's always a certain specific sound that I'd like the orchestra to have from game to game. So if you took something like Dead Space, which I learned so much on Dead Space. None of that music was recorded live in the sense that if you listen to an action cue, I didn't have the music for the action cue written and then went in front of the orchestra and recorded it. Everything I did with the live musicians was like adding colors to my paint palette. It was all gestures and textures and scrapes and effects and lots of wild, meaning no click kinds of sounds, with just general instructions on the music, like play your highest sound as softly as you can, for the string players, or for the brass players, it might say, play your loudest note as quickly as you can with, short repetitions. So then I would take all those sounds, which there were so many of, and edit them into the computer and then play them back on my keyboard, and that's how I wrote the music. But probably 10% of the cues that I wrote when I was experimenting with the orchestra, some maybe 5% of them I recorded and then I never used because they just weren't very good. And then the other 5%, halfway through the cue, I just go, okay, let's stop and move on to the next thing, because it just wasn't working. And I had no idea. I just didn't know what it would sound like if I asked the violins to, you know, take these 8 notes and just vary them in speed randomly from slow to fast and watch my hand for dynamic changes or something like that. There was no orchestration book or music theory book that talked about how to write in 20th century techniques like that. So it was very, very, very experimental. But I also learned a lot about ranges and players. And I was at every break, I was running down and talking to people and asking them, you know, now what was that thing over there? And how high do you think it would be comfortable if you wanted to do it this fast? And same thing with the brass and the woodwinds. But I'm just such a nerd. I love, first of all, musicians in general and being able to hang out with them. If you want to get a musician to open up, just start asking about their instrument and where they got it or how long they've been playing or what they do when they're practicing or have they any, you know, have you ever played on a session like this before? Or what's your most memorable recording session? Or, you know, what's the history of your instrument? This one guy had the violin from Wizard of Oz. Like all the violin solos from Wizard of Oz were performed on this violin that he owned, which is just amazing. I mean, that's 80 years ago now. So I was learning a lot, you know, learning a lot about how the orchestra worked from firsthand. I mean, literally just diving into it. And that was one way of using the orchestra. It was just bare knuckle insanity for Dead Space. But for Until Dawn, I wanted the orchestra to sound a lot colder. It takes place in the Midwest, northern Midwest, in the U.S., and there's all kinds of snow around, like, the whole entire time. The snow's like another character in the game. So everything that I was writing, I used, like, lots of solpanticello with the strings, which is when they play close to the bridge, and it gets this real nasal sound, lots of non-vibrato as well, so it doesn't have that kind of width and lushness to it. It sounds really thin and cold. Same thing with the woodwinds and the brass. Like, I used a lot of muted brass. And even when I was mixing it, I was sort of emphasizing kind of the top end of the orchestra a little more to make it sound cold, which a lot of times people want the orchestra to sound like warm and big. And I was going for more cold. And it's a subtle difference, but, you know, we all have to have our kind of hooks to hang our hats on, musically speaking. And cold was just the easy target for me to think about in terms of, you know, orchestration, instrument choices, ranges, things like that. And then Moss, of course. Yeah, there was lots of strings and some brass, lots of woodwinds. Those were all live. Kristen Negus played flute, oboe, clarinet, and a bunch of whistles between that and the Twilight Garden expansion. She did lots of woodwinds. Then we had some live strings as well that were soloists. And then I played all the other instruments. Tiny instruments, because I wanted the score to feel intimate and small, like Quill, the little mouse, you know, ukulele and hammered dulcimer and little tiny shakers and high-strung guitar, accordion, things like that, that almost had a pub band kind of feel.
Yeah, absolutely. And one final thought that's actually jumped into my mind while listening to you there, is when you were attempting some of these more experimental things, like asking them to play their loudest note and things like that, did you ever come across much resistance to that? Because I've always been a big Radiohead and Johnny Greenwood fan, and I'll never forget him talking about when he first started playing with string arrangements on OK Computer and actually receiving some big resistance from the players to some of the more experimental things he had in mind. I think in particular, detuning while playing was the idea he had.
Yeah, there's all kinds of, you know, there's all kinds of people out there playing in orchestras. And I did have, on one of my first gigs, unfortunately, when I was conducting my own music, I was very young, very inexperienced, and very impressionable. And I remember, and I'm not going to mention it, but I remember exactly the studio I was in, the orchestra I was recording with, and everything. They weren't I will say, I was not at, you know, at Skywalker or Abbey Road or Air Studios or any place like that. I was at a much smaller middle tier studio with accordingly middle tier kinds of players, and we were doing some sort of a cue that had some effects in it, and we finished and the viola player looked at his standmate and said, you know, 6 years of music school for this, and rolled his eyes and then walked off to take a break. And I was like, oh, so that's what it's going to be like, huh? And then I was, and this was a, it was a string player. Now, I love string players. I dated a violist for like 3 years in college. I love string players. So this is not a knock against string players. But they, I think of all the instrumentalists in the orchestra, they're the most classically trained and they're the least kind of pop crossover. I mean, you got the percussionists, they might be playing drums in a big band. The horns and the brass, geez, they're probably doing other stuff as well. And then even the woodwinds might be doing some things. But strings are normally just focused on classical repertoire. So when I got to Dead Space, I was wondering what that would be like. And in the back of my head, I was a little nervous, but it had been probably 5 years and I'd conducted a lot more gigs and done some live things and felt more comfortable in the studio. And actually, the problem that I had with Dead Space is it was like I was dealing with a room full of kindergartners because they were so giddy and gleeful and happy and excited about all these crazy things that I was asking them to do that they kept doing things like laughing at the end of a take and ruining the take because we were trying to get reverb. You know, I'd hold up my hands and I'd cut them off and there'd be and they're all laughing because they're having so much fun. And I really think it's one of those things, again, with the string players, especially because there's more of them. You know, you've got, you'll have 40 or 60 string players to what is maybe 10 or 12 woodwinds or brass, maybe only a couple of percussions, because the strings just aren't that loud. So as a result, basically, unless they're the principal in their section, like the first chair, they're taught to blend in. They're taught to, you know, like round out the sound and support it. They're not taught to stand out. You know, their vibrato and their phrasing and everything, it needs to be exactly like everyone else's vibrato and phrasing in the first violins or the second violins. And that's, I think, subconsciously part of their personality as well. That's why they're drawn to those kinds of instruments. So when you give them a piece of music that says, just, you know, take these notes and play whatever you want. And instantly, one of my favorite techniques that I got on the first Dead Space was literally just the whole string section playing any note they wanted to, really, really quietly. And it wasn't even written down. We were just doing it sort of at the end of the hour because we had, you know, 2 minutes left. And as soon as I said that, I said, I just want everyone to just pick a note and just play it as quiet as you can. Ready? Here we go. And like five violists put up their hands. They were like, now what do you want? And I literally dismissed them. I was like, it doesn't matter what string you play on. It doesn't matter where on the fretboard you play. I just want you to pick a note and play it really, really quietly. And I put up my baton and, you know, we were rolling and I gave them the cue and what came out was like the most wonderful jazz chord that you've ever heard. Because it was literally like a 52-note jazz. I had the whole string section there, from violins down to basses. And everyone's eyes kind of got big because it's like you heard, it's like, is that the root? Is that like flat 9, sharp 11, add 13, sus 4 over the tritone inverted with the, you know, or is it maybe in, you know, your brain's trying to analyze the chord? But everybody was just like, oh, that's really cool. And I didn't even know if it would work or not. So we recorded it for like 60 seconds. And I was like, okay, play the exact same note you just did, but we're going to do a swell. Like, we're going to go from quiet to loud. Just watch my finger. And it was just, you know, like a 30-second quiet to loud. So we did like 4 of those as a sustained, really quiet, and then just a very subtle swell. And that ended up being basically what was considered the quote-unquote safe music in Dead Space. So if you were in, there was this one place where you could go where you knew you weren't going to be attacked and you could repair your suit and do some upgrades and stuff. And the audio director, as soon as we finished, we had the break and I walked into the booth. He's like, that's going to be the music for the safe room, or whatever the technical term was. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. It's like, yeah, that's all we need. It's perfect. It's like, it sounds like Dead Space, but it doesn't sound threatening. And it sounds like you're floating, but it doesn't really, he was a jazz bass guy. It's like, it's floating, but it doesn't really have a root. Like, I just want to jam on that, like do a bass solo over that whole thing, like on my upright. And that's what they did. They used it for the safe rooms, and apparently it worked really well.
Well, there's been so much insight in this, and I mean, just in that one answer there, and from the string players to all of the different attitudes and everything like that to the different games, I think despite any cancellation you might have had to put up with at GDC, you've managed to pack quite a lot into this.
Well, thank you. You had some really good questions.
Oh, well, you've had a career that has inspired them. So this is becoming all very self-congratulatory now. Right, so one last time, thank you so much for all of that, Jason, and I know we could have gone a lot longer, so we'll definitely be catching up in the future.
I feel like if we were in the same room, Lee, we would have ended up like jamming, and there would be a drum set and a bass in the corner, so yeah, the virtual talk was great. I really, really enjoyed the questions.
Absolutely.
And thanks for having me.
Well, we'll have to make that jam happen sometime, but yeah, until then, thanks so much for coming on again, and goodbye for now.
Okay, great. Thanks, Lee. Talk soon.
Good night. Bye.